The only thing we have to fear is fear itself. Fear itself. Fear itself.
From the Center for History and New Media at George Mason University, this is Digital Campus, featuring Tom Scheinfeld, Mills Kelly, Amanda French, and Dan Cohen.
Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country. Fear itself.
This is Digital Campus, episode 69, recorded Friday the 13th, 2011. Strange Bedfellows. Well, welcome to another edition of Digital Campus. I think this is number 69. We're really getting up there, not as quick as we had hoped, but 69 is not bad. I'm here with the regulars, Mills Kelly. Hey, Mills.
Hey, Tom. How's it going?
Pretty well, pretty well. Dan Cohen.
Hey there, Tom.
Hey, Dan. And Amanda French. Hi, Amanda.
Hi, Tom.
And we're joined this week by one of our irregulars, Steve Ramsey. Hey, Steve.
Hey, and actually, the first time I've ever been on with Amanda.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Oh, great. All right. Well,
we'll have to get some banter going.
Oh, yes. All right. We'll have
fighting.
To turn
we're
up the banter.
Encouraging fighting on the program.
What we can do is exchange news about all our friends from graduate school. That will be riveting for the listeners.
Right. Oh, I forgot you guys are. You go way
back.
Yeah,
I saw Brady Earnhardt last
night.
We go
way back.
Yeah.
I don't think we should go there. I think that's on the credit. I'll just say that.
Well, thanks for joining us again, Steve. It's been a while, and we're glad to have you back. We actually have a lot of news this week. There's quite a bit going on with the Google I/O conference and some big acquisitions, some familiar names in the tech industry. So why don't we jump right in? But actually, before we do, Mills, why don't you tell us a little bit about your recent travels? I understand you're just back from down under, as they say.
That's right. I just got back from Australia. I'm actually, as much as I love it here at George Mason, I'm very sorry to have left Australia. I'm now trying to figure out how to wangle a job there for the twilight of my career. But one of the things that, I mean, I had a great experience there. There was a conference called After Standards, and the Australians managed to do something that the Americans failed to do, which is, or at least it looked like they had managed to do it, which was agree on national standards for history education. But in their case, they went K through bachelor's degree on these standards. And so I was there to go to a conference on the implementation of the standards. And a couple of weeks before we got there, the new government in Australia, they just had an election. The new government decided that they were not interested in those standards after all. What was interesting in the Australian cases compared to what happened here in the States in the 90s was that, you know, in the 90s here, we just threw up our hands and said, okay, fine, forget it. We won't do it. In Australia, the people who I was meeting with decided, you know, we like our standards and we're going to go forward with them, even with or without government funding to support it.
Well, that sounds like a great trip, a kind of working trip, but it sounds like you weren't working.
As much as one can work living.
Working the whole time.
Yeah, well, I was in Coogee, which is a beach community in the eastern suburbs, so I managed to spend a little time outdoors.
Very nice, very nice.
Sounds good.
Well, let's start here today with I think it was the biggest news of the early part of the week. We're recording here on Friday. Oh, at Friday the 13th. So we'll all watch what we say and watch out for black cats and things like that. Microsoft made a big acquisition, I think the biggest acquisition in the history of the company, to buy Skype for $8.5 billion. What do people think about this big acquisition by Microsoft I guess it's a sort of social networking play. Is that how you see it, Dan?
I just don't get it. I know we're on Skype right now. We rely on Skype. We curse it repeatedly on the podcast for it flaking out. It strikes me as very odd. I mean, I guess, I'm trying to think about it from the perspective of academia and museums and libraries. I mean, it has become a kind of standard tool. I think there are a lot of students, for instance, foreign students at our university that use Skype really as their primary communications platform with their family in Asia, let's say, or Russia. We've got a lot of international students or students with family who are international. And so, you know, I guess it is something that's got 200 million users and they're worth something. Whether they're worth $40 a person, I'm not sure about. But, you know, it seems just like a very odd thing for them to do. You know, I don't really see how, you know, I mean, Google was able to create a voice platform without buying Skype. I would think that Microsoft still has some people who know how to code and could do this. And so I'm just a little perplexed about the whole thing. I do think that one thing that Skype has done well, and the reason actually I use it with family who are abroad, is I mean, what really made it take off was NAT transversal, which is a really funny way of saying that it had some technology that was able actually to get through the home router without you configuring the router to accept a Skype call going through it. And I don't know if people remember, but Apple had, you know, was out of the gate pretty early with iChat AV, which had voice capabilities and video capabilities, but you could never get it to work because somebody had to like open a port on their router to let the traffic through.
Yep.
And when Skype came along, it had this automatic NAT transversal that allowed people to just, you know, have it work. I mean, it works. It works 85.3% of the time.
It was a defensive move, actually. I think that Microsoft may have purchased Skype so that other people didn't purchase Skype. You know, eBay bought Skype, and they had no idea what to do with it. That may be the case for Microsoft as well, although they may have plans, who knows, to work it into, I don't know, Xbox Live or something. But I think that a lot of these tech companies are defensive. You know, they didn't want anybody else to buy Skype. I read in one of the news stories that they had some kind of clause during the negotiations where Skype wasn't allowed to negotiate with other companies such as Google. So, you know, I mean, Skype is such a standard and so many people use it for so many things. I'm not even sure if Skype is all that profitable as a company. I don't really know, but
Skype has ever posted a profit. I think I read that.
But it's one of those things, you know, not unlike Twitter, where the term itself has gone into the language. People often use Skype to mean, you know, you over IP, whether or not they're using Skype, but they usually are using Skype. So it's a kind of thing where it's such a popular piece of software and service that you don't want anybody else to get it and do something great with it.
Go ahead, Steve.
I was going to say that I think I understand why someone would want to buy it, but this is one of a series of acquisitions that have happened later where I don't understand who is buying it. Like, I don't know why the entity, like, I don't know why Microsoft goes after it. I mean, the cell phone companies have hated Skype since the moment it appeared. I mean, they've absolutely hated this thing, and they've been on a 10-year plan to destroy anything that lets you make anything that looks like a free call, right? They destroyed Vonage. They destroyed, you know, they have mercilessly gone after every voice over IP company. So I can understand one of them wanting to go after Skype and bury it. And I was sort of half expecting that to happen. And then Microsoft, you know, comes along. And I mean, that's the part I don't get. I mean, they do have some, you know, Microsoft, you know, there's all kinds of battles going on in the tech industry where people are betting on, you know, we want you to do everything on your cell phone, or we want you to do everything on the web, or we want you to do everything on our operating system. You know, Microsoft doesn't strike me as a company that, I mean, they've sort of seeded that vision, or they have too confused a vision of what that future is going to be. So it just seems like an odd thing. Like, I would understand any cell phone company buying them. I would understand Google buying them. There are all kinds of scenarios, either to bury it or to develop it. But Microsoft, you know, I can't imagine why they'd get in that game.
Well, I'll sort of be the devil's advocate here. I don't quite get it myself, but here's two ideas for why Microsoft might do it. I think one is, I mean, it is a lot of money to pay for a social network, that is the network of people. But Microsoft needs to make a social networking play. At least they think they do. And this $8.5 billion, I mean, it's actually not that much to carry with it that many users. I mean, imagine if they tried to buy Twitter. It'd be a lot more than that, and it'd be about the same number of users. So they get a whole bunch of people. They get a whole bunch of usernames. Problem is, I mean, Microsoft has had usernames in the past and done nothing with them. Hotmail is a good example. So that's one idea. I actually think that the question of the cell phone companies is a really good one. I actually think Microsoft might have done it to improve their negotiating position with those cell phone companies. I mean, they are really trying. They know they need to get into mobile to compete with Apple.
I think that's very likely, and
Google. Them owning Skype allows them to say to AT&T and Verizon and the European cell phone companies, like, we can go around you. You know, we have our own phone network, essentially. And, you know, they can make promises to the cell phone companies about what they're going to do and what they're not going to do with Skype. They can make threats about what they're going to do and what they're not going to do with Skype. So I think it improves their negotiating position in the mobile space, in the telecom space, in that way. So, I mean, those are a couple ideas. I don't quite buy it either. It's
almost like saying, yes, the cell phones companies have been scared of Skype for years. Now we want them to be scared of us.
Right, exactly.
That's a good, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, or just really scared of Skype. When I saw this news, I was actually kind of heartened by it, because not that I care one way or the other about Microsoft or Skype, but it's more that, you know, we use Skype. I use it a lot talking to colleagues around the world. And I was hoping, wow, maybe if Microsoft took it over, then the infrastructure problems that Skype seems to experience with all the things we complain about, maybe those will get a little bit better because they have, you know, a new cadre of engineers, new eyeballs looking at some of these problems. And Microsoft has some pretty good engineers working for it. So, you know, maybe some of those problems will get better, and that would make me happy. From an educational standpoint, I'm kind of excited about it because, you know, I'm increasingly interested in distributed classrooms where my students are out in the field doing historical research somewhere away from one of the buildings here on campus. And to be able to, you know, have them all linked up through a class Skype network is going to be easier if it's more sort of clearly tied to Microsoft, because, you know, our students, they're still heavily, the laptops that they're carrying around, the netbooks they're carrying around are still heavily Windows machines. And so if there's a more seamless integration between Windows and Skype, that's going to be a good thing for me.
Right. Well, another story that we've seeing, you know, kind of in the same space, and you can see some similarities, a company that was bought and then by another company which didn't really have an interest in it, the flip camera was owned by Cisco, which is a router company. It's kind of a strange combination there. I think we're seeing that now. Cisco is killing Flip, and that is also, again, Mills, to your point, is going to have some impact on doing teaching in the field.
I was just going to say, I talked to some students about this past week in class, and they're pissed. I mean, they love their flip cameras.
Yeah.
They have cell phones with video capability, they prefer to use their flip camera for that.
Steve, I know you've seen some similarities between these two stories.
Yeah, well, it's another case where, you know, when Cisco bought them, first of all, we need to step back and just sing the praise of the flip. I mean, this was just such a delightful little thing. It recalled for me a much older piece of technology, which was the Polaroid SX-70. In fact, it had the same button, and I'm convinced that the designers who built the Flip had the SX-70. This is the old Polaroid. This is this gorgeous old Polaroid camera that ran from the early 70s to the very early 80s that kind of like – it was like you know, those Transformer robots – that was like this with a camera. You know, it just popped open. It was just gorgeous. And, you know, it had one lovely red button, and you push, and you know, there's no focus, there's no white balance. You know, you just hit this red button, the camera comes out, and you wait for the magic to turn it into a photograph. And the Flip reminds me of that. I mean, it was just the point and shoot cameras. We're not point and shoot. You know, they had too much fussy, you know, interfaces and SD cards and all of this kind of stuff. And the Flip comes along and it gets that whole thing right. There's one button, you know, anyone can use this thing. It has the USB stick sort of folds out of it, and you could tattoo it. You know, you could get in all these groovy designs and everything. I mean, it's just so again, like, who hates this thing? Well, anybody making camcorders hates this thing, right? It's too cheap.
Right.
You know, it's too, I mean, they, right. So I would imagine and you know, they tried to get into the game after the Flip and they just couldn't do it. They just didn't hit the right, you know, I mean, the Flip absolutely nailed it. And
well, the other praise to sing about the Flip was that it really simplified uploading your videos to the web. Was way simpler than other dedicated projects. It's like USB stick, put it in your computer, you're done. You know, and you can upload it right to YouTube pretty much if you wanted. I mean, I read an article about, you know, why Cisco killed the Flip that made what I thought was a good point, which is that Cisco is really used to providing enterprise software and making the kind of money that you can make from that. And so the Flip was really always more of a consumer product, and they weren't getting the kind of profit margins that they wanted from that, which in a way I always thought that the Flip was going to be great for education. And I never saw any of the stories that we saw about things like the iPad, which is where, like, school district, you know, invests, you know, buys a Flip for every student. That may have happened, but if so, I didn't see it. And I thought that would have been a great thing for schools to do.
Although I will say, you know, my kids' schools, they have several dozen Flips that they use for various class projects. So they have, you know, like the box O Flips that, you know, when the teacher wants to send the kids out to do some kind of a project, that's what they do, is they bring in the box of Flip cameras and hand them all out to the kids, and they go off and record a whole bunch of stuff and they upload it and they play around with it. And so there are going to be a lot of it, especially K-12 teachers who are going to be not so happy about this too.
Well,
I mean, I don't understand why they just killed the company. Why not just sell it on the cheap?
Yeah, really. But see, that's exactly the other thing that was great about the Flip, was that they were so cheap that, you know, if you are a school or a library or something and you want to check them out, well, then it's not that big a deal if they get destroyed. You know, it's $100, you know, that's not that big a deal.
And not only that, you know, one, I'll put a link to this in the links for the show at the end. There's a great video of this guy who takes a short film. It's maybe, you know, 5-8 minutes or so. And with a $2,000-$3,000 camera of the sort that is popular among independent filmmakers and documentarians, he shoots that film, and then he duct tapes a Flip to the camera, you know, and shoots that while he's shooting. So in other words, he's gonna compare how this $3,000-$4,000 camera does against the Flip. And you know, that was a very enlightening film, because you look at that, you look at the Flip version, and it's like. You know, it's different, but I would not say it's worse.
Right.
You know, I would say it's about the same. Well, I mean, that's a, you know, nothing could be more terrifying to a company that makes cameras. I mean, this, you know, a cheap, you know, not only was it cheap, but it was good. You know, it took the video was pretty good, you know, for the size.
So I mean, I see a kind of another break line here. I think what Steve is saying is absolutely right. But I think there's now a tension going on about subscriptionless devices versus subscription devices. You know, I have a feeling we'll be talking about this Chromebook soon that Google came out with this week, which is a subscription device. I mean, you have to pay $20 a month. And I think a lot of people would say, let's say outside of academia and let's say K-12, you know, that, well, the cell phones are now have, you know, 8-megapixel cameras and 720p video. And so why do we need this independent device? But for schools, they love cheap, you know, devices that you can have a box of them. And if one dies, it's not a big deal. And you can't get, you know, a bunch of iPhones with $100 a month subscription prices for them.
That's absolutely true.
So I think there's just a tension here of, you know, whether schools will have, you know, will there be anything left that does not have a $20 a month plan on it? You know, because I think companies realize that it's just a great model. I mean, the iPhone doesn't cost $199. It costs $2,400. It's just that it's spread out over 2 years. I think that there's actually, you know, K-12 especially, but also academia is going to run into problems here with not being able to get kind of good single-purpose devices that, you know, look like something that Dieter Rams, you know, designed for Braun in the 60s and has one button and you can drop it and it's not a big deal. And that's easily replaced.
Well, let's you know, take our moment of silence for the flip and move on to the Chromebook story. I mean, here's another example of a you know, somewhat puzzling business play for a big company in the tech sector. For people who don't know about it, Google announced the release in June. They'll be selling these of what they're calling the Chromebook. And the Chromebook is essentially a laptop with just a web browser. It boots up almost instantly, and all you've got is a web browser, the Chrome web browser, which is why it's called a Chromebook. And the operating system is a very stripped-down version, I believe, of Ubuntu, but it's running completely in the background. You'll never see it. You don't really have access to it. I think there's some kind of access to it, but you know, 99% of the users will never have access to the actual operating system. What they'll get is a maximized, a full-screen browser window with browser tabs, with web applications running in those tabs. Dan, you've been following this, and it is, I think, in the education space, a subscription play. What do you think about the Chromebook? Are you getting one?
Well, no, I'm not getting one. And part of the reason why is it's actually just what we were discussing with Skype. And actually, I think this might be part of the reason that Microsoft acquired Skype, is that you can't run Skype on a Chromebook. It's not a web app. And I think it's a great case of an application that really requires root access to your computer. People don't know how Skype works. It works by using your computer actually as part of a distributed system of nodes. And indeed, some of the more powerful computers become super nodes that allocate resources and route calls effectively in a decentralized way. And so, I mean, in some sense, an application like Skype, let's say if Microsoft integrates it in Windows 8 and says, you know, all of our educational laptops come with Skype built in, you know, that's something that you can't have on a Chromebook. There will be lots of other examples like that, Photoshop and things like that. You know, I think the Chromebook is an interesting idea, and you know, it's not so new, right? I mean, it's
the idea for this, the thin client.
For thin client has been around for decades. But I do think we've come to the point now that, you know, I think about, you know, my kids are in first grade, and they go to a computer lab with a Dell computer, and it is, in some sense, it's complicated. It has to be maintained and updated. They have to pay for updates to Microsoft Office. They have to pay for updates to the operating system. They have to figure out when they're going to update the operating system. You know, which summer do they pick to update it? They have to do training with all the teachers and the students on it. It's got authentication issues. It's got, you know, and there's just all kinds of things that are nightmarish with institutional installations, especially educational institutions of installations. And so in some sense, I think a Chromebook is sort of like a flip camera. You can get a box of 20 cheap $300 laptops. You throw them down in a room full of first graders, and all they have is their ID, you know, ID and password. They log in and they get effectively their web presence. They can type things out in Google Docs. They can use web applications. I'm sure they'll allow for locking down the web to certain websites.
Can't get any viruses.
Can't get any viruses. Yeah. I mean, there's just, there's a lot to be said for it, in a sense, sandboxing the computing experience. But I still, the cost for me seems too high. I mean, I just don't know. You can get a cheap Dell box for $300 or $400. You pay it once. I know you've got the maintenance costs, but you know, you're talking to a school system that would then have to pay the $300 or $400 for the laptop and then $20 per in perpetuity.
Well, that's what I wonder is how
I just
many...
I don't get that piece of it.
Well, I don't know how many K-12 schools really are invested in this notion of one laptop per child, essentially, like give a child a laptop and let them explore, because in a way it's counter to a K-12 ethos of we're going to teach you what you need to know, right? It's not, I just saw an amazing presentation on standards-based learning in K-12 and how that's really creating the kinds of students that may not do well in college, where we like to emphasize critical thinking and exploration and creativity. So, I mean, I'm all in favor of give a child a laptop and let them learn by having that and through exploring with it. But I don't know how many K-12 schools really are even at that point.
Right, right. I mean, in response to Dan's question about, you know, Microsoft as buying Skype, and they're going to say, and I think they're right, that, that they're going to say that you can't run Skype on these Chromebooks. I mean, the problem with that argument is and this has been a Microsoft's argument for the last, you know, 5 or 10 years. It's always like last year's argument, right? It's like saying, like, they would have said the same thing about Microsoft Word a couple of years ago, but now we have Google Docs. And so, you know, that argument falls away. I mean, it's not going to be too much longer before, you know, and this is Google's bet that the web, that you're going to be able to run Photoshop in a web browser.
Well, and this has been,
that's
the dream
happened time
all along.
And again,
this has been the dream. I mean, this, you know, it's always worthwhile to begin any discussion of Google. And of course, Google comes up all the time on this program. You know, it's always worthwhile to begin any discussion of Google by noting that Google sells ads on the web. That is the center of their business. And so every play they've ever made has been, how do we get more people, using the web? Even, you know, things that don't make that seem confusing, like acquiring YouTube, make sense when you realize that they want everything
right
done on the web. And I think this has been the dream all along, you know. And you know, we should note that for most of us, or at least a lot of us, we already have a Chromebook. I mean, we open up the browser and we sit there for, you know, an enormous percentage of the
right the day
of the day. And I mean, I'm a well known Neanderthal when it comes to computing. I stay on a command line and so forth. But you know, most of the people I know, you know, an incredible percentage have you know their whole system is basically Google Docs and Evernote and Gmail, and you know, and so I don't know, and it seems to me very clear that we will get anything you can imagine on the web browser.
Yeah,
that seems to me clear that we'll get there.
Yeah, I think there are two other things that are going to have to be thought through on this if the Chromebook is really going to take off. One of those is, you know, a key part of Google's business strategy seems to be its ownership of YouTube. And YouTube is blocked in lots of K-12 schools in the United States. My son's high school, for instance, you would think high school students at least could see YouTube videos. Not in the Prince William County Public Schools, the second largest school district in Virginia. So, and this is not just in Virginia. It happens all over the country that because of, you know, inappropriate content on YouTube, it's blocked. And so how are they going to manage that if YouTube is one of their key product lines and yet you can't access it on this computer that is built entirely around their products? The second is I'll be very interested to see what they do with this. You know, schools all over the United States, for reasons I'm still not entirely clear on, are investing incredible amounts of money on these smart boards, which in some applications are, I think, quite good, and lots of them a huge waste of money. And these things are, They require more electricity than a 1960s model air conditioning system for the typical suburban home. I mean, they're just – I mean, it's unbelievable. My kids' elementary school implemented, I don't know, put up like 5 or 6 of these a couple of years ago. And the principal just wigged out when she saw the first month's electricity bill because she had to issue this edict that all smart boards will be turned off at the end of the school day every day. And if they're not, you're going to have it removed from your classroom. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, they're just unbelievable energy hogs. They're about as ungreen a technology as there is out there. And but lots and lots of teachers are developing some very interesting ways of using these. And they're the thing in K-12 education in terms of, you know, the cool technology. And so the Chromebook is going to have to interface very well with that. And if it doesn't, teachers just aren't going to use it because – they like the smart boards.
Right. That's a good question. Like, does it fit into the workflow of education?
Right.
Yeah. And that I think that's
– I'll be real interested to hear whether when they were deciding that this was the way to go, they went out and talked to teachers outside of sort of the school systems in a short drive from their campus in California. You know, did they go to suburban school districts in Kansas City? Did they, you know, they talk to people in rural Texas, and say to the teachers, so would you actually use this? And if so, how?
Right. Yeah. I mean, I the question to me is, and it's really just a sustainability model piece of it, is it'd be great if you didn't have to have a campus IT department or whatever for school, your school IT person. Because, you know, all the operating system updates are done Google side, right? I mean, in fact, they're not really operating system updates. Well, they might be at some Linux level, but, you know, they update Google Docs all the time with little minor updates. So you don't have someone going around, you know, ghosting machines or dealing with those sorts of things. But I have a feeling that's not going to happen. School districts cannot fire, and not even based on union rules. It's just they can't. They'll still need somebody to set these things up, to, you know, deal with memory problems or what have you. And I'm just not sure it ends up saving them
right, or even
a lot
just
of
hardware
money.
Breaking.
Yeah, just you know, I don't know.
Just checking them in and checking them out, having a database of, you know, a
right.
barcode reader.
Right.
You know. A child in one of my wife's classrooms a couple of years ago said, this computer's hurting me. And they didn't know what in the world he was talking about. And so when they went over and touched it, he was actually getting shocked really hard.
Oh, no.
You know, we're fifth grader, but, you know, that's not something you expect to hear. My computer's hurting me.
Right.
Mrs. Kelly.
That's fine.
I'll be interested to hear exactly how Google makes the argument that these laptops help it organize information. I don't think they can.
Right. Well, right. This is Google. I think Dan made this comment on Twitter. This is Google. Like, you know, they branch out. What was your tweet, Dan?
Oh,
something like their mission shouldn't be organizing the world's information. It should be like doing anything that computers can do.
It's just whatever comes to mind with information technology.
Yeah,
I mean,
right.
I don't know how they – I mean, I think they've just decided that they're just a general computing company, which, I mean, in some ways, it's kind of a disappointment. I understand once you get whatever 20,000 engineers on your campus, you're going to start doing a lot of different things. But, I mean, it still says on their mission page that that's their goal is to organize and make universally accessible – you know, information.
Right.
And, you know, I mean, Android, they're doing Google. I mean, is there anything they're not doing Microsoft is doing that's not what Apple's doing? I mean, they're just
self-driving cars.
Yeah. Well, here's where it all comes. Here's where actually it all comes together. Like, I think if you, you know, like ignore that mission statement was written in, you know, 1998 or whatever. If you think of them as an advertising company, it all starts to make sense. Like,
advertising on Chromebooks.
Yes, the more time you spend in the browser.
Right, but I mean, at the school level, there's no way they're going to allow ads on
It doesn't matter. I think the more time you spend in the browser, the more often you're doing a Google. There's always going to be that Google search bar in the top of that. You know that awesome bar.
I don't think that address bar
is a Google search bar. Every time anybody types anything into it, they're going to see Google ads.
I think this is their great fake, Dan. You know, because you say, well, you guys aren't going to advertise to kids, and what Google will say is no, we have no intention of doing that. It's like LexisNexis. Creating law school addicts to their product. You know, I mean, they just want to get people. If you can get a young generation to just need to get them using the web and thinking of the web as the place where you do everything. At that stage, they don't need to advertise to anybody. They just need to get people hooked.
Why would they continue to subsidize Firefox, like probably their biggest competitor in the browser market?
It only makes sense if your goal is to make sure that everything happens on the web where you sell ads.
Yeah, I really think that's true.
I want to say one just quick thing, and that is about when I think of computers in educational contexts, I think of them mostly as, you know, how do I enlist this in the project of teaching the world to hack and teaching the world to program?
Yeah, I was going to ask you just this, Steve.
I don't think we're there yet with web browsers. I would not walk into a room full of fifth graders, if I did, and with the project to teach them how to, you know, teach them about programming, teach them how to build things on the web. You know, if all I had was the browser, I think I'd lose them pretty fast. You know, I think they'd already hate me and it by the time we were 15 minutes in. I mean, and so I'd like to see Google, or maybe just the wider programming community, think about, you know, if this is the way we're heading, then, you know, we're not going to teach anybody to hack if what you need to hack is an Apache server and knowledge of CSS, HTML5, JavaScript, and, you know, we need some kind of, or, you know, yeah, it's not the place I think anyone would start trying to teach people about how computers work and so forth. So, you know, that's not a good – if that was what I had to work with and I was in a middle school, I'd be very upset.
It really is black boxed. I mean, the Chromebook.
But wasn't that disturbing in the I/O keynote about the Chromebooks? They're saying, well, this is the future of education and we're excited about, you know – people will use these things in K-12 and they'll go on and use it in their work. And I'm thinking they're not going to generate a new generation of Googlers with that attitude. Right.
Yeah, we all wrote those little basic programs in school, you know, like
where's the basic for web applications, you know, or where's the entry point where I can just, I mean, you know, this stuff is really, I mean, it's architected to have multiple layers and, you know, network programming has never been a simple thing. I mean, it's just, I don't know.
I'm not so worried on this one because I'm speaking now from the perspective of the father of a 14 and a 12-year-old, and they're hackers and nobody's teaching them how to do it. I mean, their friends are. They're taking things. They're hackers in the broadest sense of the term. They're modifying the games they're playing. They're taking their computers apart and begging me to go buy them a soldering gun. They're breaking into things. They're, you know, not like banks, but like breaking into game programs that shouldn't probably be broken into. Not my children personally.
They're breaking down the PlayStation network.
I'm glad to have all those credit card numbers. Thank you all very much. But they're just doing stuff like that, and their whole ethos is everything that exists on the screen in front of them can be modified and probably should be, and that's they just figure out how to do it. And it doesn't, you know, I think maybe I've said this before. My oldest son believes that reading a user manual is unmanly. It's just like it turns you into something horrible if you read a user manual.
I believe that as well.
Yeah. Well, good.
I think it's just responsible.
Discouragement of my wife.
So I'm not so worried that the
yes, it is unladylike to read a user manual.
But Mills, I don't think anybody's going to convince these kids not to hack.
Yeah, but Mills, all the platforms you just mentioned, I would say, are more hack friendly than the Chrome browser.
Right, that's the problem.
Like they're not saying. Like I, as I said, I think it's responsible parenting to encourage all the kinds of activities you're talking about. But, you know, I have a feeling your kids are probably not, you know, get really excited about model view controller architectures, you know, or, you know what I mean? There's something that, like, those platforms seem to be more open or more friendly for hacking than something like the Chromebook. Believe me, the Chromebook will be hacked within 5 minutes of release.
That's right. That's true.
So, you know, now, but I don't know I guess I'm thinking more about, you know, just more conventional educational environments where we're teaching people how to program and so forth. But, you know, the way to learn to program is to do what your kids are doing. There is no doubt about it.
I think you can get to a terminal window on the Chromebook. I think it's there. I just don't think it's not foregrounded in the way that it is even in Windows. You bump into it sometimes in Windows or on Mac OS, and certainly in Linux, you can't avoid it. But you don't, you know, you can get to it, but it's just not there. You know, there's no file system. There's no, you know, it's just kind of all in the background.
I still think there's also just native apps like Skype that it's just going to become obvious to people when they start using it. It is true that I do 95% of my stuff in the browser, but that other 5% I really need. And I wonder what point that people bump up against that.
Right, maybe it's maybe it's just a travel laptop, you know, thing you bring when you're on the road. You're not going to do serious, you know, you're going to do a presentation. You're going to do, you know, it could be useful for that. I mean, if they could slim it down and make it a $300 competitor to like the MacBook Air, that is your, you know, maybe not your main machine, but your travel machine. Maybe then it's be interesting.
But on the Skype and other apps issue that actually don't run in a browser, I'm reading on their Chromebook page that they recommend that you use desktop virtualization technology like Citrix, which just sends chills up my spine. Citrix is just, yeah. I mean,
do they really say memories,
that? They really say that.
No, they've made like a big deal with Citrix. Yeah.
I mean, you know, here's another thing. I mean, it's not the sexy new tablet market, but the netbook market, I mean, there still is a pretty big market for netbooks.
It's getting crushed by the iPad.
It is, but there's still going to be a market for small, cheap laptops, and Microsoft owns that market right now. I mean, you know, I mean, if you're a company as big as Google, maybe, you know, you eat into Microsoft's margins a little bit more. They're your big competitor. Right. I mean, we also have to keep this in perspective. This probably isn't the future of Google in the same way that Skype isn't the future of Microsoft. But these are like huge conglomerates. It's just like, you know, I mean, GE still sells, you know, GE sells refrigerators. They sell jet engines. They sell MRIs. They're in all these businesses. Right. They're a giant conglomerate. And maybe that's the model on which these tech companies are working rather than the kind of, you know, we think of Google as kind of a web startup, but, you know, maybe it's turning into GE.
Yeah, you know, just one minor thing, and then we probably should move on. At the same time, I've been disparaging Google, but they did put their force behind Arduino, and so I'm sure Steve and other hackers are really happy about that. For people who don't know, this is these little I don't know what you call them, pieces of robotic pieces and a development kit that you can put things together for alive entities. I'm describing it so badly here. Steve, how would you describe Arduino?
It's an open hardware platform. It's an open hardware platform for physical computing. Meaning it's a microcontroller, not a microprocessor. So it's designed to enable things that move and things that blink and things that sense. And it's about the coolest thing I have seen in my entire life.
They are so much fun. So much fun.
There have been Arduino workshops at a few that camps, and I've never been to one. And they're so popular that I've got to go to one at some point.
You know, I will say, just to close out this discussion, you know, it may not have a lot of rhyme or reason, but the stuff that comes out of the Google I/O conference is pretty cool. Like, it's kind of all over the map. You know, it's it is, you know, if Apple, you know, is the kind of you know, svelte money-making machine. You know, Google, it still sort of is. Like, it's like Google I.O. is kind of like an academic conference where there's stuff that, you know, there's just like random stuff that's just all over the map. And there's like, you walk into a session and you think, well, I don't know how this is going to be. And it turns out to be really cool and great and off the wall. It still does have that ethos. So I encourage listeners to, you know, if you haven't seen the news coming out of Google I.O. and you want to just hear about some, you know, cool, wacky new stuff, that's a good place to look.
It's still like Google is the academic company of these three, right?
Yeah.
Isn't it? Yeah. Okay. Sorry.
Yeah. No, definitely.
But it almost like runs itself like a computer science department with computer, like a CS convention is more like what their things are rather than product announcements.
Right. Right. Exactly. Well, you know, speaking of academics, before we go, we probably should mention something about what's going on campuses rather than all the news that's coming out of industry. We saw I think last time or the time before about the Digital Public Library of America initiative. It looks like it's gaining a little bit of steam, and they've made an announcement just recently about a code rush. Amanda, you suggested this story. What are they calling this new event they're hosting?
They are calling it a beta sprint. It's not exactly an event. It's more they haven't actually released the call to developers yet. That'll come out in a week on May 20th, I believe. But they have announced that they will announce plans for what they're calling a beta sprint, where what they're going to ask people to do is come up with some kind of demo version of the DPLA by September 1st. So beta sprint, they probably should call it an alpha sprint really, but they want people to, you know, build something that adheres to the guidelines that the planning committee has put together, which includes, a text focus for now, hopefully something that can be built out to include audio and video, but for now a text focus. It's going to be, you know, begin with public domain content, drawn from existing projects like HathiTrust and so forth.
It seems like a great idea. I mean, it addresses a couple of I like it for a couple of reasons. It addresses one of the big criticisms, I guess I didn't make a real criticism of it, but one of the things that made me uneasy about the early discussions about DPLA is that, you know, they're proposing a Digital Public Library of America, an open library for all Americans and for everyone around the world. And like, they have their first meeting at Harvard, invitation only meeting, you know, it just felt kind of wrong.
No
offense to the people on this podcast who were there, but you know what I mean? There was, you know, it just to launch it in that way.
My smoking jacket.
Right. Exactly.
At the Harvard Faculty Club.
Right. No less.
It was
astonishingly tone deaf of them.
Yeah, it was.
Yeah,
but
there's been a lot of criticism from people who are really invested in public library activism.
But this.
But having been there, it really, people were aware of this issue. I know it was a little tone deaf, but.
And I'm sure they were. And like, you know, the people involved, like you, Dan, you know, are not tone deaf to these issues. So I mean, I trust that that's the case, but it just the optics of it were bad. But this sort of is a reversal of that. I mean, this is like, you know, hey, everybody, you know, have at it. See what you can do.
And the other thing that
which
I
is
have
really
to say
a cool way to go about it.
Yeah. The other thing that I, at least, and I think we in general were maybe a little snarky about near the end of 2010 was being a little suspicious that this kind of mammoth ambitious project would ever get off the ground. And I have to say that when they released what they called the concept note, I was astonished at how at the ambition of the speed by which they wanted to get some kind of demo version up and running, because often with these really, really ambitious projects, you know, you can just debate it for years, literally years, before anything gets built. So it actually feels like so fast to me. It feels a little too fast for me, but that's good. I'm glad to be feeling that discomfort, because if they get a number of potential models for this by September 1st, that's doing great.
Right. And a code sprint is really a good, right. It is a really, so the code sprint, not only does it address the kind of exclusivity of the early meetings, you know, those undemocratic optics, it also addresses this idea of like, how do you get such a mammoth project going quickly?
Yeah.
You know, a code sprint is really, so it really is actually like, I think a very, very good strategic decision. I mean, you know, Steve, you were at 1 week, one tool, and, you know, giving people a deadline and saying, you know, go build something by a certain date is a really nice way to get something off the ground.
Well, I mean, and this, you want to talk about a project that could absolutely be in committee forever, right? I mean, like we could have a development meeting that goes on for 20 years.
Right.
You know, we would have no trouble doing that and just say, and you know, to say to a bunch of coders, look, you just go build the thing and show us and then we'll see.
The only thing that I'm a little worried about with this, and maybe this will change when they get to the actual announcement, but so far they have not – they're not offering a prize. You know, maybe people are invested enough in this that they'll just do it anyway, because I think probably the people who will try this out will be coders at institutions, you know, like maybe the University of Michigan will try to build something. I mean, who knows? And then the other thing is that the text of the you know, this pre-announcement, it was released on the DKLA discussion list, the email list, which anyone can join, but you can't really see that unless you're on the list. But one of the things they say in this announcement as well is that there won't necessarily be a winner. Exactly. They're you know, they're going to look at all of the proposals, and you know, they kind of reserve the right to say that, oh, you know, several of these proposals,
right,
we'll
take all the best
submits.
Ideas and
right.
Yeah, that's a little bit worrisome. I mean, you know, I maybe Dan, we shouldn't talk about this on the podcast, but you know, it seems like, you know, like CH&M would be well placed to build a prototype of this, and with no promise of a cash prize and no money up front, and not even the promise that like you're gonna, you know, be chosen to actually go do the implementation stage, where it's really just like they get a bunch of good ideas, they take the best, and then they go build it. You know, whoever they is, they go build it themselves. Right. You wonder if that's much of an incentive to a research unit on a campus or a library unit on a campus to invest staff resources in this kind of thing.
Yeah, I mean, my read on it is it's actually, maybe I'm being slightly pessimistic on it. I'm very supportive of the project, as people probably know, listeners probably know, but. You know, Tom, you prefaced the beginning of this segment on the DPLA by saying it's showing momentum. I actually think this is a sign that it's not showing momentum.
Interesting.
That there's a lot of talk, as Steve so rightly pointed out. I mean, boy, you know, there's five different committees, you know, legal and content and audience and all these things. You could sit there and talk forever about the legal frameworks or the sustainability models or what content should be in and what content should be out. I think this is a way for them. I think it's very smart to say, you know what, let's stop talking a bit and let's actually see some just prototype implementations. Give us 20 of them. You know, even if they're really, I think, cheap and dirty. I mean, I think they're actually just asking people to, let's say, use Google custom search on top of a list of 400 libraries and adding thumbnails drawn using the API from Internet Archive and, you know, blah, blah, blah. You know, I think they're just asking people to kind of duct tape together some services and to show them like what could it actually look like? Because I just think we're at the point where each of the specific issues are just so complicated. You know, what does public mean?
Right.
What do we do about orphan works? What, you know, and I just think, you know, it could be the kind of thing where it's eternal planning, and it'd be better to see something, even if it's poorly designed and has all kinds of problems or can't quite access all the data. I think it'd be useful. So
right.
I guess
something just to argue against. Like,
yeah, right, exactly.
We've all come to that stage in building a website or web development project or something where, like, you know, you talk and talk and talk about what it'll do, and really what you need is just something to look at to say, you know, well, that is definitely not what I had in mind.
Right.
Well, this is why this is a lesson well absorbed by any graphic designer. You know, I mean, put something in front of people, you know, they will talk forever. You know, I mean, wireframe it quick, show us some pictures, and you know, well, those five committees, we won't need them after we're all staring at something.
Right. Well, it'll be interesting to see what happens. I mean, I hope they do get a good response to the Code Rush, and I think it's an interesting idea. I think I certainly don't take any credit for this, but it is this idea of Code Sprint is an idea that's in the air. It was we absorbed it in one week, one tool. We've seen it. The Bamboo Project has been pushing forward with some similar initiatives, and so it'll be interesting to see what they come up with there. Well, I think we're just about out of time. We've been on the podcast nearly an hour, and it was good to have all of you on the line. Steve, thanks for joining us again.
My pleasure, as always.
And we'll hope to have you back very soon with the regulars for another edition of Digital Campus.
The only thing we have to fear is fear itself. Fear itself. Fear itself.
Please visit us online at digitalcampus.tv, where you can join in the discussion and let us know about stories and issues you would like us to cover on future episodes. Mike O'Malley wrote our theme music.
Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country.
Thank you.